law school. It's an investment in your future. But like all investments, without the right advice, it can lead to disaster. That's where Pre-Law Pro comes in. Whether you're exploring the law, navigating the admissions process, or need personalized career guidance, at Pre-Law Pro, we've got your back. Don't gamble on your future. Invest in it. Get started today at prelawpro.com.
How can I make myself more competitive?
How do I build my network?
I want my career to go to the next level, but I don't really know where to start.
I hate the job I am in. What else can I do?
I want to work in healthcare, but I don't want to be a doctor.
I need connections in a new industry. Where should I start?
Whether you're a college student trying to decide on a career path, a young professional trying to develop their career, or maybe you're in the mid to late stages of your own professional journey and you're looking for a new challenge, or maybe you're facing an unexpected job search. Whoever you are, wherever you are, welcome to the Professionists Podcast. And together, let's find your fit.
Welcome back, folks, to another episode of the Professionist Podcast. And in this week's episode, we're going to talk with founders of LSAT preparation company, LSAT Engine. The LSAT is the most important part of any application to law school. It's by no means the only component of the application, but it is by far the most important. And it's crucial that if you're going to law school, that you get that piece of the equation right. And a big part of that is getting the right LSAT preparation. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that today with our guests, the co-founders of LSAT Engine, Josh Lord and Justin Capuano. But as well as talking about the LSAT, what we're really going to explore is their journeys in entrepreneurship to actually taking the LSAT Engine from an idea to an actual company now that serves aspiring law school applicants all over the United States. Both Josh and Justin started out as tutors themselves, focusing on the SAT and ACT, and between them have helped thousands of students prepare for the GMAT, the GRE, and the SAT and ACT. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the developments that we're seeing in those tests in the interview. However, after working in test prep, they realized that there was an idea that they both had to bring about a more cost-effective, efficient and innovative way of delivering the LSAT to law school applicants in an online form. And they did it with an eye to making quality LSAT preparation available to everybody, regardless of their background or socioeconomic position. As we go throughout the episode, feel free to head on over to LSAT Engine and check out all of the services and products that LSAT Engine has on offer. You can also follow them on Instagram and on Facebook at LSAT Engine. And for our listeners today, if you decide to go ahead and use LSAT Engine for your LSAT preparation, use the code PROFESSIONISTS100. The details are all in the show notes, but use the code PROFESSIONISTS100 and you'll get a $100 discount off of any of their products. And all you need to do is use that code when you fill out the form that says, how did you hear about us? In that field, just put in PROFESSIONISTS100 and you'll get that discount. And without any further ado, let's jump on in to the episode. Welcome back, folks, to another episode of the Professionists Podcast. And in this week's episode, we're going to talk to the founders of LSAT Engine, Justin Capuano?
Capuano, yeah, you got it.
Capuano. I knew I'd butcher it.
All right. It's intimidating. It's scarier than it looks, yeah. It looks scarier than it is. Yeah, you got it.
Gosh, well, there we go. Justin Capuano. Folks, how not to introduce a guest and his business partner, Josh Lord. Josh and Justin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it.
How did you guys meet?
Josh, you want to go ahead? We tell them how...
So Justin and I attended UCLA together. We were friends from the start, known each other since we were essentially 18 years old, and we're fast friends in college. We're in the same fraternity, Sigma Alpha Epsilon. Justin was the president for a period of time, and I held an office as well. So we worked together very, very early on the board of directors there, and had just been friends and clicked early in our careers together. And strangely enough, very, very early after college, and I think Justin, to some extent, even while he was in college, we both kind of found tutoring as kind of a side gig. So not only did we have sports and a lot of life things in common, but we were also really interested in thinking about for-profit education. It was a great job to have at that time in our lives because it was extremely flexible. So we had some business interest very early on, long before there was ever talk of LSAT Engine, long before I really knew what my career path was. And I think in retrospect, as I look back, that's something that I think makes us work well together is we've had that trust and we've had that period of time together. We didn't just find each other at some mixer and say, hey, you've got these skills and I have those skills. So yeah, I think that was sort of the genesis of it.
Yeah.
Justin, as an engineering mate, did the idea of going into business seem natural to you, or was it sort of a gear shift?
It was a little bit of a gear shift. My parents are entrepreneurs. They have a chiropractic clinic that they have run together for almost 30 years now. And so that was almost a red flag and made me not necessarily want to be an entrepreneur because I saw how hard they worked. I saw their lack of breaks, lack of vacations. They were putting 7 days a week in frequently. So I actually wasn't fully planning on being an entrepreneur when I entered college. It just so happened that as an engineer, it took me a while to figure out that I wasn't actually going to get to do any hands-on building. I love to build things. It's always been sort of a passion of mine. But in college, I quickly realized that engineers at that level sit in front of a computer and use software and do equations occasionally, but rarely get their hands dirty. And so I gravitated towards it because of my desire to build things. But ultimately, I steered myself towards entrepreneurship because I wanted to actually build something rather than just be a cog in a machine or design a small component for a satellite or something.
Yeah, there's no way to do entrepreneurship from a hands-off perspective. You really got to get involved from the start.
Absolutely.
I do want to turn to the question of tests because, Josh, you mentioned that you both were involved in tutoring at a really early stage. And I think for a lot of people, whether you're a high school student, whether you're a college student preparing for the GRE or the LSAT or the MCAT, or whether you're a professional thinking about going back to grad school, standardized tests intimidating for a lot of people. And a lot of people, myself included, don't have a natural inclination for standardized tests. So what do you think helped you both just take fairly naturally? I'm sure you had to do some work and prepare, but what do you think helped you both take to those tests a little easier than some?
I think speaking for myself, I was always naturally good at tests. I was lucky enough to not have that sense of anxiety. And I liked kind of the deductive logic involved. I liked problem solving. There seemed to be a real need for it, especially at the time. As I was growing up in the late 90s and early 2000s, there weren't that many companies out there that prepared students. Certainly my high school, which was quite a large high school on the border between Long Beach and Los Alamitos in Southern California, there would maybe be like a weekend boot camp that would happen every so often that would prepare students. And they were woefully unprepared when they started. So when I first started getting into it, there's a little boutique firm down in Santa Monica that said, hey, I think we can do this in a better way and really affect some positive outcomes here, get some big score improvements, and then have the opportunity to mentor folks. So I started at the ACT and SAT level. That's typically a test taken by 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds. And I had always really liked that age group. They were adult enough to be able to be, especially in a one-on-one setting, reasonable to talk to, but they're still sort of malleable and sort of putting their identity together. And at least at the time, the landscape has changed quite dramatically in these two particular tests, but you could really have a positive impact on these folks and really sort of change their trajectory for college. One of the things I always wanted to do was to, since I grew up in Long Beach, in an area that was quite diverse and one that didn't have, had some socioeconomic issues, that I got involved with a charity reasonably early on to be able to work with folks from the inner part of the city. And you could just see, they thought, my goodness, maybe I'll go to community college. I'll tough it out there. Maybe I'll get to a state university. But when you gave them the tools, they were some of the most successful students you could ever imagine. And so to watch them start to apply to the UCs or to Michigan or to USC and then change the complete trajectory of their life and their career, that really inspired me early on. And that was something that I think I was passionate about pretty early. And I thought, since I have this skill set, why not give this a shot?
You mentioned that the landscape has changed. I think what you're referring to is the fact that a lot of colleges have now gone test optional mm-hmm. and are no longer requiring those tests. Mm-hmm. And you also said that one of the things you felt was appealing was the ability to help people change their career trajectory and even their family tree mm-hmm. by getting into a good school. How do you feel about the position that some of these colleges and universities have taken on not making standardized test scores mandatory? Does it hurt or help?
I'm kind of under the impression that it hurts. I recognize there's a lot of great arguments about the biases that come along with these standardized tests. And most of them are, the unfortunate part is that it's quite expensive to get a good tutor. And so they tend to be, there's bias towards folks who don't have the resources. But I think many of these colleges are throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Now, I think what we're seeing, even just at an early rate, folks are now, the wealthy parents are now spending a ton of money on the other metrics that are involved. So folks are now spending a ton of money to get to pay someone to write their kid's essay or to put their application together and doing those things. So really now it's just shifted into the other metrics. And it's difficult when, even just in Los Angeles, I can't speak for the greater part of America, but I assume it's also the same, that unfortunately, grades aren't all created equally.
No.
There are certain schools where you show up and you participate and you do an hour of homework a night and you get a good grade. And then there's other schools where you are grinding. For each class, it's an hour and a half or 2 hours. At the AP level, maybe more. And it's really difficult to just look at, without a standard, just look at grades, GPA, personal statements that can be completely manipulated. And while I think there are compelling arguments from the folks on the other side that say we can make a better test, I would love to participate in some of those because I have some ideas myself. But to just get rid of all of them and say, you know what, this is it. There's not going to be a central standard that we have to judge you by. I think it does a disservice. And I've always come from the side that if you give some of these students that are underserved and socioeconomically challenged the tools and the resources, they perform wonderfully on these exams. And that really can be something, especially if I'm thinking of one anecdotal situation of a student who it was actually very hard for him to get good grades because he couldn't get a quiet place to study at his house. And it was very small and there was a lot of commotion there. He had to travel a long way across Los Angeles to a school that was actually a pretty good school, but he's on the bus an hour and a half each way. And so it was just very difficult for him to maintain the amount of busy work that is required. But he had the natural horsepower and he had the appropriate gearbox to do very well on the standardized test. And he did so. And it completely changed. So it actually was helping to balance out his application when they may have looked and said, you know, your grades aren't as great as your peers at this particular high school, but your SAT is great. We're actually going to consider you. And we're going to consider how well you've overcome this challenge. Because it's probably a whole lot easier to be 10 minutes from the high school and not an hour and a half and then have that quiet room of yours to study. So I think they're taking away an opportunity for students. And I think the conversation should be shifted to how can we provide more resources for those that are underserved? How can we make the test better? How can we improve upon the test as opposed to just saying, let's not test anybody?
Yeah, I'm sure that there were some altruistic motives behind it. Mm-hmm. But I also wonder whether there was some underlying panic in higher education about the next class once COVID hit, and especially some of the implications for people who were preparing to take those standardized tests. And it was easy to dress it up as something else, but at least a component seems to be, hey, we need to maintain our enrollment numbers, which is, it doesn't seem like the right motive to have. Justin, your specialty is the LSAT. You've had scores of 178, for example, 175, right up there in the 99th percentile. And it's a different test to the ACT and the SAT. And you were an engineering major, not what we sometimes think of as the stereotype kind of poli-sci pre-law student. What do you think made the LSAT not an easy test, but what do you think helped you do so well on that exam so consistently?
Sure. The mechanical nature of logic, I think, is often overlooked. Like, I certainly didn't know about it until I started to study for the LSAT. I didn't know. A lot of students are just totally blind to the whole field of study of logic, like conditional statements and contrapositives and all the different sort of logical flaws that one can commit. You get a little bit of that in rhetoric class, maybe as an English major or a philosophy major. But most people are totally blind to this whole area of study. And I certainly was as an engineer. I didn't know about philosophy or logic until I encountered the LSAT. And I think the section that I initially really was drawn to was the logic game section. It was the most intimidating section at the time. The test has gone through these cyclical periods where different sections are harder or easier. So the late 90s, early 2000s was a period where the logic games were just a destroyer. You could miss 4 points and still get a 180 because the curve was so forgiving because the games were so hard. And with the game section, these days, somebody who is in the 99th percentile is probably getting a minus zero or a minus one. Back in those days, it was very common to get a minus three or four on the games. So that section in particular really appealed to me because it's essentially a puzzle. And you're constrained by these rules, but it's very black and white. There's no ambiguity. You can't get caught up on flowery language like with reading comprehension. That reading comprehension was the most challenging subject for me because I didn't write a lot of essays in college. I didn't have to read a lot of books. I did a lot of math and solved a lot of equations. And so I really had to expand my vocabulary for the reading comprehension portion. But I looked on that as a challenge. I thought these are actually true stories about interesting topics. And I looked at getting better at reading comprehension as a way to sort of broaden my horizons. I could still rattle off like a dozen artists that I've learned about through the reading comprehension section and all sorts of historical trivia. So the logic game section and the reliability of it. You know, with English, you have these rules like I before E, except after C, and when sounding like A, you got all these exceptions to every rule. But with logic, it's like math in that if you do it correctly, you arrive at the right answer 100% of the time. And I like that about the LSAT.
Why do you think logic is so intimidating to people? Is it because we no longer teach logic at the high school level? What do you think makes it so intimidating to people? Because certainly in my experience, when people encounter logic for the first time, it just seems like this huge monster and they don't quite know where to start.
I think it's because it's like closely tied to your assessment of how smart you are almost, because it's like, it's really just your ability to crunch facts together and come up with reasonable deductions or inferences based on those facts. So a lot of folks, when it doesn't go perfectly the first time, they almost feel like it's an indictment on like all of their analytical skills. Like, man, I'm just not a good, clear thinker because I missed a couple of logic questions. And I think that, yeah, it hits close to their core, sort of their identity with regard to like how smart they think they are, which is a shame because it's really your first practice LSAT is like taking a calculus final on the very first day of calculus class. Like, it's going to go badly. You haven't learned any calculus yet. And people would get that in the context of a math class, but they already expect to be good at it because it's part and parcel of how we communicate and how we convince each other. Like, we're using logic all day, every day, but we don't really know it. And so some of us like figure out, oh, there are rules and I can get better at this. And other people just turn up the volume of their voice and they're like, this is how I argue. And it seems to work. So yeah.
Humility is an important piece of learning.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. But yeah, it's very close to how we think about a lot of other things. Logic underlies a lot of other important aspects of human cognition, for sure. Hmm.
Yeah. Well, Justin, you actually were a co-founder in another LSAT test preparation company, and you sold your interest in that and went in with Josh on LSAT Engine. Walk us through how that came about. So you knew each other in college. Obviously, you were already in the LSAT space. Josh had done a lot of tutoring in the college admissions test space. How did you guys come together to decide, first of all, to focus on the LSAT and to actually start LSAT Engine together?
Yeah, a great question. One aspect of the story that I love that when you were asking Josh about how we met, post-college, so we were good friends in college, but post-college, because of our tutoring jobs, we would often find ourselves working until relatively late in the evening. My LSAT classes were often from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. because that's a time when you could guarantee that college kids would be available for such a class. Mm-hmm. And so we would get done with class at around 10 p.m. And then both Josh and I share an affinity for poker. And so we would, one of us would pick the other one up. We'd hop in the car and drive about 30 minutes to the casino and we would play poker till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning on a regular basis, like a couple nights a week for a very long time. And so we spent a lot of time together. We had a lot of good conversations about our various endeavors separately. And he also came up from a company. He was one of the first employees at an SAT company that grew to be $50 million plus company, and he opened up markets for them. And so we had very analogous experiences at our test preparation companies that we worked for separately. My LSAT company that I were the first one that I worked for, I had the experience of realizing that the books that they were passing out were printed on or were composed in Microsoft Word, which is not even really a thing anymore. It's like Google Docs. But from the outside, it seemed like this very complicated organization. But from the inside, it seemed like a house of cards. I was like, oh, so anybody with desktop publishing software and a computer can do this, can go ahead and start classes. So I think Josh had a not that quite exact same experience, but a similar one to where he realized that these are just people and you can hire people and you can make a curriculum and there's nobody, there's no sanctioning body that says you are mm-hmm. or are not allowed to start a test prep company. You just do it. And we both had strong opinions about things that the companies that we were respectively working for were not doing correctly or could be doing much better at. And so we held on to those ideas and they became things that we would be eager to implement once we started working together.
How did you take it from, hey, I think this could be done differently or better, to let's start a company from the ground up? Because I think a lot of people have ideas.
Sure.
But there's a very small fraction of people who actually turn an idea into action.
Yeah. Well, one nice thing about being a tutor is that you get a little bit of free time because it's when you are working, you're pretty well compensated for the work that you do, especially for high stakes exams. If you're a good enough tutor and you start to build a robust book of business, you can raise your rates and you can make what effectively might be like a full-time salary in a 20-hour week or a 15-hour week. You can work full-time pay for part-time work is what we used to say. Mm. And so that gives you a lot of free time to put something together. And so we were lucky in that we had that flexibility. We could still pay our bills. We could manage to pay our bills with tutoring while we were grinding on the curriculum or getting a lot of the logistical apparatus set up.
Josh, what was the order of things? Did you come up with a business plan first? Did you have the bones of a curriculum? Or how long did it take to get to a place where you're like, okay, we're ready to go to market? And what was that process like?
It took quite some time. Shortly after I left that company that was doing the SAT and ACT, I kind of branched out on my own and did some tutoring myself. And I kept thinking about the skills that I had developed over time and the mentorship that I had received at that previous company. And there was always something in the back of my mind that said, I could totally do this. I could totally do this. And I think that there are some opportunities here. I think there's still some meat on the bone. I think this company has done some incredible things. I think they've transformed a good piece of education, but I want to get some technology involved. I think I noticed that I was saying the same things over and over to students all of the time. And that it was just, I mean, even I taught classes as well, but my classes would never get above maybe 30 students. And I kept thinking to myself, the internet could teach everyone at the same time. And Justin, I think, arrived at that conclusion, if not at the same time, then certainly earlier than I did. But I realized that I didn't have great sort of rudimentary business skills. I had great sales and marketing skills, and I could hustle and I could smile and dial and I could meet somebody and do those things. When I was young, I had unlimited energy and had a passion for coffee that still exists. And so I didn't mind working hard hours, but I didn't really have any accounting background or finance background. I didn't know a ton about economics other than maybe an AP course and maybe one at UCLA. So I knew that I had to start getting some of those skills. So I took a few courses at UCLA Extension, found that I really enjoyed the early finance courses, and then talked to the folks that I was working with before who said, you should go back to business school. We know you can kick this GMAT's butt, probably don't have to pay for it, and you're going to get a lot of these skills. You're going to get a great network out of it. Mm. So why don't you give that a shot? And so kind of tabled that idea. I think Justin was probably already starting to generate the idea for LSAT Engine, which went through many phases. I think, is it going to be a GMAT first? Are we going to try and do ACT and SAT in a better way? Are we going to move into GRE? We didn't exactly know which of those particular acronyms we were going to target first, but there was a period of time from 2011 to 2013 where I kind of set those ideas aside. I was still doing some tutoring on the side, but I was really focusing on trying to build out my business skill set and increase my Rolodex outside of just the for-profit education folks and the college counselors that I had been meeting over the previous 5 to 7 years. So it was when I graduated that Justin and I kind of had a sit down where we said, we've got a chance to do this. And at the time, there wasn't a lot holding us back. No mortgage, no children, no, none of that. This was the time. And I guess to take a half step back, during business school, I had worked for Launchpad LA, which was a seed level accelerator that would inject between 50 and 250K into new interesting tech companies. And it was kind of overseen by Mark Suster, one of the famous folks in the VC world, and had a lot of really talented folks there. And the time that I entered there in the 8 months I was there, 8 out of the 12 companies got funded with their next round of capital. So I watched that piece of it and I watched how passionate the entrepreneurs were. I saw that they didn't mind working the long hours because of how vested they were. And seeing that from the other side of the table was pretty intriguing to me. And I was able to parlay that into working for what used to be New World Ventures, but is now Pritzker Group Venture Capital, mostly funded by the private capital of the Pritzker family. And I got a chance to see another piece of the equation where now it's not 250,000, now it's the 1 million to 25 million injection. And to watch these companies grow into that next phase, I was just so fascinated by it. But what fascinated me most was actually the growing of the companies, not the money generation and having these strategic investors that are coming in and perhaps controlling the rudder of the organizations, but just how these entrepreneurs evolved and how the skill of running a company with 5 people was so much different than the skills required of somebody running a company of 100 people. And I think what inspired me most was the entrepreneur aspect of it, were the neat people that I met, passionate folks. And so when I finished in May of 2013, I had some other offers on the table. One that my parents are pretty unhappy that I didn't take, or at least were at the time. But I said, Justin, we have some overlapping skill sets, but it is a Venn diagram. You can do a lot of stuff I can't do. We have some complementary skills here, and I've got some experience in things that maybe that you don't have. Why don't we take a shot at this? We've seen a couple people. That first company I saw did incredibly well. They have since grown exponentially. And so I thought, let's give this a shot. Let's do it now. And I was recently armed with Excel skills that I didn't really have before and thoughts about how finance actually works. And so got a chance to start utilizing all those skills as opposed to slotting myself into some other wheel.
So one of the things that I think is intimidating about starting a business is capital, getting the capital. And then I think what keeps a lot of people from going all in on the pursuit of being an entrepreneur is the lack of dependable income. Don't have benefits, health insurance. Once you go in, you're in on your own. So did you guys kind of continue to work as tutors and then make getting LSAT Engine off your second unpaid job? Or had you kind of built up a little bit of a nest egg and decide what we're going to give ourselves 6 months to start to get this to a place where it's ready to go? And like, how did you approach it?
We had saved up a little bit of money. I think we each kicked in some money to sort of get the paperwork going and to do the very minimal sort of legal things that
LLCs
one needs to do.
And that kind
exactly,
of stuff.
Exactly, establishing the LLC. And no, we definitely continued to work our tutoring business as well. We started LSAT Engine. It was just two jobs, essentially. Tutored, and then around the tutoring, you worked on curriculum or shot videos or worked on the website, worked with the graphic designer to figure out what the website should look like, all that stuff. Yeah, luckily, having been in each seen a test preparation company essentially start up from scratch, or at least go from early and small to large and successful and big within a couple of years, we both kind of knew the path, the lay of the land, and what things needed to get done to get the company up and running. And so made a big checklist and started crossing things off.
Did you do a lot of it? You mentioned that you had a graphic designer, but did you do a lot of the filming and kind of thing yourself? If so, what was the learning curve like?
Yeah, it was
steep. pretty steep.
Steep and tall, yeah. We did everything ourselves, from setting up the video studio to the code in the website. Like, I still write lines of code in the website. We've had some great employees who've done some great projects for us, but we still have our fingers in everything to a certain degree. One of the aspects of it that I find most satisfying is, like, you always get to wear new hats, which as an entrepreneur, you either love it or hate it. And I certainly look back on all the skills that I've developed as an entrepreneur and starting LSAT Engine, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to grow in those ways and to learn those things. I want to be learned until the day I die. Like, I really hope I am a lifelong learner.
Yeah.
So
I think early in the business, it pays to be that generalist, and it pays to want to try something new and be okay at it not succeeding right away. So Yeah. When I say that the learning curve was steep, it was incredibly steep in many ways. I had to learn how to video edit from scratch. I never edited anything except for maybe a video on my phone for my mom or something. There was nothing, not at this level, not being able to put something out. I think that was what was most exciting. But speaking from the financial side of things, we just knew that we would have to be quite frugal in our own personal lives during that time. And we would have to ask favors of friends. Certainly, big shout out to Justin's grandmother, Grandma Jo, for letting us use her garage. You had to be scrappy in the beginning because a film studio is incredibly expensive, especially when you don't have a ton of dough coming in.
Especially in California.
Goodness gracious. Yeah. So yeah, I think we had to find ways to get things done as cheaply as possible. And we didn't really want to source any money from institutions. Mm. I think we had both seen it from the outside. I had certainly seen it from the other side of the table. And a lot of times, I think this particular business is niche enough that we wanted to be entirely in control of the rudder the entire time and didn't want to go and do things that we didn't want to do. We, from the get-go, wanted to have a social mission and not turn anybody away because he or she couldn't pay for the course. We wanted to have that be a part of it. That's maybe not something that VCs would be too excited about because that affects your bottom line. So at some point, I believe it was 2015, we reached out to some friends and family to get a small round just to help us with marketing expenses, just to help us with getting more terabytes into our hard drives, getting the tools of the trade. And then, of course, at some point, Justin and I couldn't do everything anymore. I couldn't call on everyone in the country. Justin couldn't teach every class. So at some point, we had to do like a personal loan that way just to be able to afford our employees. We're happy we went that route because we've had to give up no equity in the process. Our investors are great. They're silent investors. They want the best for us, their families, and friends of family. So that, I think, was the move that we've used. And we've sort of eschewed the idea of getting capital because the other thing that I saw in my short time in that space is that if you, as a young company, if you get a bunch of money, you're liable to spend it. You're going to find a way to start spending it. And oftentimes they're on things that you don't actually need. Things that are nice to have, but that you don't actually need. So luckily, we both had tutoring there on the side. I mean, we weren't sleeping on a cardboard box and eating ramen every day, but it wasn't too much further from that. It was living frugally. And
you're tutoring this whole period right up until the getting the additional loan, you're doing basically two jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
When did you transition to start hiring people? What point did you have to get to where you could safely say, okay, now we're at a place where in order for us to continue to grow, we actually do have to bring in somebody. And as a follow-on, when did you start to get paid in this life cycle?
Well, our very first hire was that graphics designer. Uh-huh. We farmed out some of the front-end development to a consortium of folks in India. It was a great learning experience. It was incredibly challenging. Sometimes their work product was excellent. Sometimes it was late and terrible. But
is this through like Fiverr or Upwork or something like that?
We used both Fiverr and Upwork. But where, Justin, was it Clap Creative? Where was it that we ended up getting the Indian folks?
DK was our point person. And I'm trying to recall how we were introduced to him. He didn't come through because the graphic designer came through Launchpad. I recall that. Your connections at Launchpad led to that graphic designer. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if he led to DK or whether that was an Upwork. It might have been an Upwork thing because I remember putting it out on Upwork. But then we got a couple of not so great responses. And then maybe it was. But I think we might have found him on Upwork.
Hmm.
Yeah, I really pulled back on all the strings I possibly could at Launchpad for some of those early folks. And because there was, frankly, so there's many things you can do as an entrepreneur, but you also have to know what you absolutely can't do. And I appreciate art very well, but I can't draw at all. I just do not have those skills. So that was really, if we're going to have a website, it needed to look good. And if we were going to have marketing materials, they needed to look good. So that was somebody we found right away. And I think the very next hire after somewhat of a programming debacle we had there was to find somebody who could help with the business development side of things. So I was starting to get so many emails from various student organizations and other such places across the country, law advisors and that sort of thing, that I just couldn't answer them all. And so I needed somebody to help me with that and help me actually triage which ones are really important, which ones can we wait a little bit longer on, how do we set up these webinars initially. So that was, we opened our virtual doors in July of 2016, kind of did a little bit of beta stuff before that, but it had taken us a solid 3 years to shoot all of the videos and get the working algorithm and to really put the program through its paces. So it took from that May 2013 to July 2016 to really get that going. And then once we opened up, it was clear we're going to need somebody to help with customer service because I can't answer all the calls. That's just not possible. Not enough hours in the day, not enough bandwidth to do that. And that's where we started bringing folks on. And one of the things I learned from my first company, and I think Justin had mentioned he had seen this too, is it was great to hire people that you had worked with before or sort of younger, hungry folks that wanted to see the inside of a company and realize you couldn't give them the McKinsey salary or the Goldman Sachs salary, but that you were going to learn all of these valuable skills and that they would be very vested. They would have a material impact on your product and or your service. And that really excited the right kind of people, those that wanted to do that when they saw us list at various colleges in Los Angeles, got so many great resumes from students who said, this is what I would like to be an entrepreneur, but I don't know the first thing about entrepreneurship. And I'd love to be a part of this. Here's my skill set. I'd love to lend it. I'd also love to learn. And you could pay me this fair wage. I know I'm not going to get wealthy here, but maybe my skill sets are going to improve such that my next company is going to find me super valuable. So it was around 2016, I think, when we really started ramping up the hiring.
And I'm guessing the virtual assistants would have been an option, but you have, often they're offshore in another country, so you've got time zones to deal with, and like some of the work product might not be as reliable. But from what it sounds like, you actually really enjoyed working with people in person, so obviously pre-COVID, but who had mm-hmm. this passion for wanting to learn and go off and start their own businesses down the road.
Absolutely. Yeah, it almost gave me an opportunity to be a different type of tutor a little bit and to share some of my knowledge with folks. I had been the recipient of so much great knowledge from that first company, from folks that were more senior than me, and now I had a chance to kind of give it back a little bit.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is wonderful when you get somebody that is passionate about it and then also puts out great work product for you. And I think just given the space that we're in, sometimes there were communication problems. Sometimes, I mean, this is a very particular product. And so having those great communication skills, actually having somebody interested in pre-law or matriculating to law school at some point in their future was really helpful because the skills dovetail.
I just wanted to add on to that. Many of our employees have actually also gone through our program, which is a nice bonus that you wouldn't have with a virtual assistant or anything like that. So, and to Josh's point, they also feel a sense of ownership, I think, when they get to work on a big project. One of our coding interns worked on a great project for us that he used as the centerpiece of his application for summer internships. And now he's working at Robinhood and is up in San Francisco loving life.
Wow.
Mostly off of the back of this project that he did for LSAT Engine, which is great. He did great work for us and he got this boost and got to see a lot of stuff from the inside. So it's really been a good symbiotic relationship with all of our employees.
I think one of the things I'd like to talk a little bit further about is the actual website itself. So I think for people, it's maybe not so much for younger folks who have always grown up as digital natives, have always had high speed internet, but for us older folks where we know a time without cell phones and without the internet, mm-hmm. jumping in and starting your own business can be extremely intimidating, especially when you're confronted with the fact that you can't really have a business these days if you don't have an online presence in a meaningful way. And it is it is your storefront. That is, in many ways, the first encounter a potential client has with you is on your website. So did you start out using kind of one of these purchase platforms and then building it out? Or did you say, look, this is going to be a big piece of our infrastructure, and so we're just going to go in and find someone who will build it from scratch? Or how did you approach that? Because LSAT Engine is different to a lot of LSAT test prep companies in the sense that, I mean, you guys adjust the material that people study based on a diagnostic test, which is, as a non-computer expert, sounds like it would require quite a bit of sophisticated coding.
Yeah, that was one of our value propositions, was how good our website is at assessing your skill level in various areas and then targeting material to your skill level. So if you're very good at something, you get harder questions and harder concepts. If you're struggling with something, you get easier questions and easier concepts until you get better. And then you get the medium and hard stuff as well. Like it's constantly the website, not just on your first diagnostic, but with every quiz you take, the test, the website is learning more about you and targeting material towards you. And so we recognized from the get-go that that was going to be a big differentiator for us. And so we started with a custom website. Like that's a lot of what I do is think about how the guts of that should work. And I got the first version built from scratch. The Indian folks were great at helping us put a lovely skin on it, that the designer, who we were also so lucky to find, designed. Those are two of our, the designer was maybe our best hire. We got very, very lucky that the initial version of the website is still somewhat close to how it looks today. It's had a lot of feature improvements, but the look and feel that our first designer really sort of set for us. Yeah, it was a big investment. We thought long and hard about whether we wanted to go with like a pre-built solution or roll our own. And ultimately, we decided that the flexibility of rolling our own was going to be worth it.
We actually found that, you might find this kind of interesting, Justin and I did a lot of this on pieces of paper where we were just diagramming things out and trying to draw things, lots of brainstorming sessions. We actually found it, to make this happen, we would have to be around each other quite a bit. So we actually got an apartment together with a third room that we made into a film room. And on either side of the film room, we had these giant whiteboards. I think the name escapes me, for the Whitey board, I think, that you can sort of paste on the wall. And we would have daily and sometimes late night sessions where we're there with markers and post-it notes and just diagramming things on the wall. So we couldn't just go directly to the graphics designer and say, hey, make us a great looking website. We had to actually give him some parameters for that. So that was actually really, really helpful for us, because in those early days, as you mentioned, there was a lot to think about in terms of just the math behind the algorithm, long before the computer coding came in. Just how are we going to deliver this? How would we do it if we as tutors were actually inside the computer telling it exactly what to do? So thank goodness for those Whitey boards, because regular whiteboards are quite expensive on when you get the good ones. We did a lot of that diagramming ourselves in the beginning. Yeah,
we actually took some inspiration from the GMAT. When Josh and I both took that test, we were impressed by how it adjusts to your skill level. And we actually researched that algorithm. And our algorithm is largely based on the one that the GMAT uses, the way that they multiply probabilities together to pinpoint what the probability of you being a certain skill level is the same underlying core concept that drives our algorithm. So it's got a little bit of GMAT DNA in it.
And what about your marketing strategy? Did you try and do this mainly word of mouth? Did you set aside some time to come up with a very distinct kind of plan? Because it's not a massive space, but it's not an empty space either. There are a couple of big players in the LSAT in particular, in the LSAT space, and some of them have been there for quite some time. So how did you come up with a plan to break into that market and to take some of that market share away from those larger players?
I think we really had to think about, where are our customers? That's the first question. Where are we going to find our customers? And the answer was very different than ACT and SAT, where you would reach out to college counselors who would be the gatekeepers, or ETSAs. And typically the sale there was to the parent. So that's a very different sale than when you're actually reaching out to students who oftentimes make that buying decision, even if mom or dad pays for it. They're doing the research. They're more sophisticated than a 16, 17, 18-year-old would be. And so we try to think about, where are those folks? Those folks, there was enough data that we could find online that said they typically are in these majors. They typically are in student organizations that are somehow connected to law. Or tangentially connected to law. There are groups on campuses that not only feature that, but then there's also a center oftentimes, the law advisors and that sort of thing that we could go after. It was much more challenging, though, to get to the students directly, because when I first started out, I could always call the school and speak to the college counselor. And that was just, you build rapport immediately, and then you would go see somebody in person and sit down and show the data, and you establish that relationship. And then if they take a chance on you and you do really well, you have that relationship built over a long period of time. And this was much more difficult, because student organizations turn over every year. The president might not be the president anymore.
Yeah.
And sometimes the group shrinks, sometimes they disband, sometimes new groups come up. So that still remains a challenge. That turnover is a tricky piece, especially at the LSAT level. So we just thought about that. And luckily, Justin had seen the inner workings of his previous company. So he kind of knew the ropes. He kind of knew although I will say probably, and you can speak to this better than I can, Justin, but things were a little bit different in 2005 than they were in 2016. So yeah.
YouTube was invented in 2005, just to kind of contextualize things. So there was no, online was not really a thing. In-person classes were the norm. And so just even convincing students to take an online course has been a bit of an uphill battle, made easier by the pandemic. Certainly everybody's acclimated to Zoom now, but some students to this day still feel like there's some magic powder that they're going to get when they walk through the doorway of an in-person classroom that is going to make them extra smart. But yeah, it's still a little bit of a tough sell. So, it's changed a lot, and it continues to evolve.
We've talked a lot about some of the things that you guys have done well and that journey from idea to actual standalone business. But I'm sure that, as with any business, there were some missteps along the way and some lessons learned. What were some of those missteps and lessons?
You want to take that first, Justin?
Yeah, we definitely, like, one of the adjustments we made, we used to put a lot of effort into going to this law fair circuit. And not that it hasn't led to some positive outcomes, but by and large, it turned out that the juice just wasn't worth the squeeze. We were spending tens of thousands of dollars to put this package together by the time you paid all your admissions fees for these various events. And it turned into a bit of a distraction, to be honest. I think that one of the just an example of a larger category of mistakes that we could make that would just be labeled distraction. Mm. When you have, until you find product market fit, until mm-hmm. your customers are so happy that they're telling everybody that they know that this is the product for you as well, that should be the focus. And I think that we got sort of distracted by some marketing efforts that didn't pan out. We got distracted by, there was an opportunity at one point to go international very early. We had this sort of promising contact that spent a lot of time and resources sort of courting and wooing, and with the option of maybe getting some LSAT classes started overseas. Yeah, I regret that. I think that was like a distraction for sure. Yeah.
I would say one thing that I've learned the hard way over this journey is that it's okay to not have to do everything yourself and to micromanage everything yourself and to let your employees shine and let them do what they do best. Give them that autonomy. I think early on, because we had to do everything ourselves, because we frankly didn't have the capital and didn't have the contacts and we didn't have these great employees that we had now, we would do absolutely everything ourselves. And that's not sustainable. And you find that out really quickly, because then you're not sleeping properly. You're maybe a little bit more abrasive than you would normally be if the situation were different. I think that letting our employees, once we started to get a staff, be able to kind of shine on their own and giving them that space has been great. And it's taken some of the stress of trying to have your fingers in everything, which is absolutely what you need to do if you're going to bootstrap a company from nothing to something in the beginning. But once it's something and you have some other folks there, you need to kind of be able to pull away and maybe give them some guidelines, but then let them run with it. And that took me a little while to disconnect, especially on the sales and the marketing and the finance side of things. And I've had to learn that the hard way. But yeah, I think we've both seen that.
Definitely.
And I think it's important, and we've said this a lot on the podcast, no one has achieved anything in life without making some mistakes and failing mm-hmm. forward along the way. Mm-hmm. So I think as we talk about these things, just remember that this is a necessary part of the process. One of the questions that I ask every single guest is, where do they see their profession, their industry going in the next 10 to 15 years? Because seeing the increasing use of artificial intelligence and machine learning mm-hmm. in medicine, in law, in management consulting. And you guys were innovative in the sense that you were an online platform from the get-go. Where do you see test prep generally going in the next 10 to 15? We talked a little bit about some of the uncertainty regarding the ACT and SAT. Mm-hmm. The LSAT is in its own state of flux right now in terms of its mm-hmm. format. What do you predict will happen in the next 10 to 15 years to standardize tests in the way that they're administered?
I think most of them are going to be administered online in the future, especially we've seen this, the LSAT in particular became the LSAT Flex during the pandemic. And the College Board, parent company of the SAT, said that it was going to do something similar here in the future because, frankly, they had to cancel. Over the last 18 months, they were canceling tests left and right. It just was not feasible to have 500 kids at a high school location, 40 to a classroom with a paper and a pencil. It just didn't make any sense, mask or otherwise. It was too much of a liability. So I think the vast majority of these tests are going to be administered online. I don't know that everyone will be universally, and there may not be a paper and pencil option in 10 or 15 years, but I think we're seeing this trend go there. And I see that for the LSAT. I don't see the LSAT going 100% back to paper and pencil. And they've said as much. They've said as much to their licensees. So,
do you think they'll go back to the testing centers with a tablet? Or do you think they'll keep doing the at-home flex format, even if they go back to five sections. Because for those of us who aren't familiar with it, it's a five-section test pre-COVID.
Pre-COVID, that's right. And it's at a currently four-section test. They've shaved. It was a three-section test for a while, and then they got – so they're getting closer to that traditional format. And they've expressed interest in going back to – this was a year ago on a webinar. They said that they, as soon as they could, they would like to get back to that in-person tablet-based administration. That said, I think that the online circumstance with the proctoring is getting better. The online test has been very well received. I think LSAC did – an excellent job converting quickly to the online format. They have an order of magnitude fewer students than the SAT. We're talking a couple hundred thousand versus 10 million, I think, is the comparison. So the logistical challenge for the SAT folks is greater to proctor that many online exams, but it's also a great challenge to administer something like that live and in person. So I think they're up to the task. I wonder about testing centers as well, because the GMAT and the GRE were not given in a classroom setting, but they weren't done at home either. They were done in these Pearson testing centers where you make an appointment, you go in, you get a little cubicle. So I could see that as a potential middle ground where you have a real live proctor, but you're doing it on the computer. I could see the LSAT finding a home in that format.
And not having to take it at set dates, but just being able to take it at when you're ready, which is the best time to take any test.
It's great. Yeah. The flexibility of taking a GMAT or a GRE, I could go take either one of those tomorrow if I was so inclined. Yeah. And I'm sure I could find an available walk-in time slot at a testing center. So yeah, that is. And with the LSAT competing with the GRE, which is what effectively has motivated a lot of the changes to the exam pre-pandemic, they were concerned about increasing uptake of the GRE with regard to law school admissions. I could see them, they seem to be chasing after other benefits of the GRE. So why not emulate it in that regard as well?
Help us understand, I guess, what makes LSAT Engine an ideal place to go for your LSAT prep. So we talked about some of the adaptability of the curriculum, but walk us through, if you are thinking about taking the LSAT, as I'm sure a lot of people are, why might they want to consider landing at LSAT Engine?
LSAT Engine is just sort of a great marriage of the benefits of online learning and in-person supervised learning or tutoring. That's kind of how we came up with the way things should work. Is we started from the point of, if somebody had unlimited money to spend on a private tutor to learn the LSAT from start to finish, what would that look like? How would that go? And well, the first thing they would do is the tutor would give them a test and figure out what their strengths and weaknesses are. And so we do that, but we do it online. And then the next thing the tutor would do would be to start teaching them some question types and seeing how they do. And if they're struggling, the tutor would ease off on them. If they were doing really well, the tutor would find some harder questions to give them. And that's what we do. We've automated the aspects of tutoring that can be automated so that we can keep the price way down. But then we also have live folks monitoring everybody who goes through the LSAT Engine program. So unlike other online courses, at LSAT Engine, you get assigned a performance counselor who you are in dialogue with throughout your entire LSAT journey. They're watching your progress. They're harassing you if you start falling behind. They're checking in if you look like you're genuinely stumped or stuck on a plateau. It's accountability. Yeah. And myself included, I still get an email every time a student takes a practice test, and it gives me their score they just got and their previous scores, and I'll reach out and say, hey, you know, look, your first score in the 170s, that's amazing. I love getting emails like that. And so it's really we're still small enough that we can give people a lot of really great personal attention, and they can have this private tutoring experience at a very affordable price.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. I think I would also want a prospective student to know that Justin and I haven't just said it and forget it. And we're just sitting at the top of this business and letting it run on autopilot. We're involved in it every day. We love to speak to our customers and to incorporate their feedback. We are just really interested in continuing to iterate the course so it gets better and better. And that's something I think he and I are passionate about. I think maybe some folks that are listening that didn't know a ton about institutional investment and that sort of thing, this was a business we care deeply about, and it's not just about let's build something as quickly as possible and then sell it to Kaplan or sell it to some other of our larger competitors. And this is something that we're interested in continuing to build and to be that market leader by consistently making it the best one out there. So, and then also to bring that private tutoring experience to everyone. We have partnered with LSAC to be a part of their fee waiver matching program. So we have a strong social mission that guides us. We feel strongly that you can still do well, you can still pay the bills and do good at the same time. So we've partnered with a lot of organizations that typically help out underserved populations. And that's been incredibly important to us as well. So we're in this thing for the long haul and we care deeply about it and we're involved in it every single day. So know that you will have somebody that's, you don't just buy the take the ride. You have somebody watching out for you. You have somebody watching out for them. If you have good ideas, they might just be incorporated in the next version of the website. And I think we're generally about half the price of everybody else. So I think we're pretty affordable.
And if you do want tutoring, you have a package where you can actually do the course, but then also have that additional tutoring as part of that package.
We do.
You know?
We do.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another unlisted benefit is we recently started doing office hours at least once a week. And on weeks where we're leading up to an actual LSAT or for the couple weeks leading up to an actual LSAT, we'll schedule several sessions a week where students can get their questions answered in a very similar to a private tutoring setting, with more just a small group setting, essentially. And then, yeah, we do offer tutoring packages for students who want to purchase that, who want to do some one-on-one work, which we collect so much data at LSAT Engine. That's another great thing about the program is when you do decide to do tutoring with us, we can look at your history and immediately know everything you've been doing, where your strengths and weaknesses are. We just have, it's a very effective program to tutor through, for sure.
And you guys have been kind enough to give our listeners an actual fairly substantial discount on the course. So again, all of the details will be in the show notes, just below the episode notes here. But if you go over to LSAT Engine and use the code PROFESSIONISTS100, Justin and Josh have given you a $100 discount on their course. So thank you so much for making that available to our listeners. And thank you again for joining us here on The Professionists.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks again for joining us on another episode of the Professionist Podcast. If you'd like to find out more about the LSAT Engine and the products that they offer, head on over to lsatengine.com. You can also follow them on Instagram and Facebook at LSAT Engine. And again, please go ahead and use that discount code PROFESSIONISTS100 for a $100 discount off of any of LSAT Engine's learning and course preparation products. Thanks again, and we'll see you soon on the Professionist Podcast.